That was Desafinado, as you know, and you know that it is the Portuguese for discord, and the program uses it as its theme music because it's a program of discord, that's to say, not the usual stuff about celebs and bestsellers, but we try to go a bit beyond that or around it, if you are above it, if I may say so, and write up and talk about what is going on in publishing. Is it part of a general scaling down of our entertainment and our film, theater, music, book appreciation? Is it true that there's sort of that we are heading for a very low common denominator? Is there hope? Are books doomed anyway, technologically? And you don't have to hear exclusively my opinions about it, but I'll have a number of guests always who will talk about it from different points of view. When I say my, I'm Hans Koning. I'm a Dutch-born American novelist. And my first novel was The Affair, which came out 40 years ago, almost to the day, published by Alfred Knopf, who hated it, but published it all the same. And it was a success at the time. This I now speak with 40 years of grave downs and a few ups, a rather hectic period in publishing, and certainly not a period to be very happy with. But, of course, one must not give up hope, and we don't. Tonight, the guest, if that's the word, I don't really like that word guest. It's sort of a bit phony baloney, like host and guest in television. But anyway, the man here who will say a lot, more than I, actually, because he's very well-spoken, it's André Schifrin, who became quite known outside the book world by the great conflict he had with Pantheon. He was for quite a number of years editor of Pantheon, publisher of Pantheon, which was partly part of Random House, and they did very serious books. They did a lot of political books. They were progressive, as most thinking people are, and also they made money, believe it or not, for the big bosses. But the time came when the big bosses wanted more money than they made with traditional publishing. And there was a conflict, and André Schifrin walked out and or was fired. And a number of other editors of Pantheon, they were not necessarily in sympathy with him personally, but it seemed then at that point a matter of principle to walk out of that particular conglomerate, which was really doing, and they're still doing, a rather unfortunately lowbrow stuff. André did not retire to a bar in Greenwich Village and pull out yellowed descriptions of his work, but took the bull by the horns and started his own publishing house, which is non-profit. When you say that, people usually laugh in the book trade because they say, oh, well, that's easy. It doesn't take a particular effort to be non-profit. Anyway, and it's the New Press, and here he is, André Schifrin. André Schifrin, delighted to have you as my guest, if that's the word, on this program. You are, as many people, contrary to what you may think, a publisher who has earned his stripes by standing up against the establishment, if that's the unfortunate name for what's unfortunately at the moment the boys in the back room who run our publishing houses. And moreover, as a happy coincidence, you wrote a book about the subject I have been holding forth on all the past year, and it just came out, so I was very glad that we could move you to this spot, because you have been writing about the same thing I have been talking about. The book is called The Business of Books, and business is a bit of a dirty word in this context. The publisher is Verso, because publishers usually don't use their own publishing house to do their own books, and André is, of course, the publisher of the New Press, which is in Manhattan. So, since we are on the subject, although I don't, it's not a review because I don't review books in this program at all. We talk about the ups and downs of publishing, more downs than ups at the moment. And of course, it's precisely your subject. So have a go at describing your subject in a few words, if you will.
Well, I'll be glad to, Hans, and I'm delighted to be talking to you, though I will disagree with one noun that you used, and that is saying that I stood up to the establishment. The establishment is an old phrase dealing with the cultural and social elite of a given country. And what I'm talking about now are the new international conglomerates that have taken over publishing and indeed most of the media. And these are not gentlemen, and they're not the old elites. They're very much a new class of very ruthless businessmen who are controlling what we read and what we think and what we see. And so it's, I think, important to make the distinction between, you know, the five major international conglomerates that sell control 80% of the books that are sold in this country, and the old establishment, which had many faults, but which was a very different kind of thing. And in fact, in the book, I give examples of the kind of censorship that one group, the old establishment, used to have, and contrast it with what the Murdochs and the new houses are doing now. And those are very different approaches to politics and to literature and to books. And, of course, these are the people who are now in control.
But listen, no, I immediately qualified my use of establishment, which I very much meant to be sound as in between quotes, and said something that the unfortunate people who are in the moment in control of most of our publishing are, in that sense, the publishing establishment of the moment, but certainly not an establishment of gentlemen, but more an establishment of the kind of like the train barons of the railway barons of the late 19th century. It seems a comparison that comes to mind. Okay, yes, go on.
Well, what I'm trying to describe it in the business of books, and which is the thesis of the book, is that for many decades, for most of the century, American publishing was indeed controlled by an establishment, the old establishment. I don't deny that, but they were limited in the amount of profitability that they wanted. The people who ran Knopf and Harper and so on were quite satisfied with making 4 or 5% a year as an average, and that's the amount that's still being made by the family-owned houses in Europe that still exist today. What's happened now is that the new entertainment conglomerates, the conglomerates that make profit from television and radio and film, have taken over and have turned publishing into an adjunct to the entertainment business, and have also expected to make the same kind of money as they make elsewhere, which is 15 or 20%. And that has meant a total transformation of the output of the major houses, which is detrimental both to our culture and to our democracy. And that's what I try to detail specifically, because this is a change that is really a major one for the U.S. and a very dangerous one.
Well, indeed, it is precisely my feeling about all this is after it's 40 years that my first novel came out. And that's what I have been talking about on this program. But slightly, gives your book what we've done here a slight different slant is that you only talk about nonfiction, while I only talk about what I call serious fiction. So I would like you to be specific now and about what's happening and in the last few years about serious fiction. I define that as fiction which is in which people write what they want to write and they don't listen to agents or publishers. They try to produce literature.
Right. No, I do talk about fiction and the decline of serious fiction in the list of the major houses and the decline of translation from foreign literatures and so on. The decline is perhaps too gentle a word, the disappearance. I think what we see in the catalogs of the large houses, apart from the well-established bestsellers whose names are already such that they will be published automatically, is that the large houses will not take on a book of serious intellectual merit in terms of fiction unless they think it can have a huge sale. And, of course, these are contradictory terms. My old German colleague and publisher now in Germany, Klaus Wagenbach, points out that the first books of Brecht sold 600 copies and the first books of Kafka sold 800, and they would never be published by the large German houses today, and certainly not by the American houses. So we have a change which is not simply nonfiction. It applies to fiction. It applies to ideas, however expressed. And it is a kind of form of censorship, of market censorship, as I call it, which is going to affect the way people can read in the coming years.
Yeah. No, and that's very striking, this first novels of well-known authors. I have mentioned it too. Another aspect is that, first, if you remember, the first novel of Graham Greene, the first novel of Penelope Fitzgerald, were quite awkward books. And if they hadn't had the chance to to publish those and learn from it, they may have ended up in a completely different career. So that is also cut off now, I would think, in the present regime. There's one thing in your book, which I, by the way, read in one fell swoop, which is definitely different from what the tenor has been in these programs. That is that you seem less, I and my guests have often thought that the university presses are sort of a green light and hopefully a way out. And if I have it right, you are very skeptical about that and see that they also are already on the slippery slope.
Well, I think that's true of a number of university presses. I think the difficulty is that we live in a very homogeneous society, and what I'm talking about is the replacement of the old value systems where you had liberal professions, where publishers and doctors and lawyers were able to do what they thought best for their clients, as it were, regardless of the monetary aspects, with a system which is entirely geared to making money. And this has happened now at the universities as well as in the rest of the world. And one of the frightening aspects is that many of the universities now ask for profit from the university presses, but they ask for profit from their own departments. A university such as Chicago, which is true to its own teaching, now expects every department, including the press, to be a profit center. And I'm told by people there that the accountants go around every quarter as if they were in a large corporation saying, why hasn't the Department of Linguistics made the profit they expected to, and why hasn't the university press, and so on and so forth. So what we're dealing with is a broader issue, which is the disappearance of the old standards of what a liberal profession can do, the disappearance of independent judgment, the disappearance of the ability to say, yes, this is something that we need to do because it's good, and the replacement of this entirely by how much money will this make. And, you know, I say in the book that the idea of the free marketplace of ideas was not supposed to be how much money can you make out of each idea. But that's really what's happening, and if the idea is expressed in fiction or nonfiction is irrelevant, the criteria are the same.
Yeah, well, it becomes important because another subject, if I have time, I want to touch on anyway, which interests me very much, because my books have usually been called tendentious by people like Chris Lehman Haupt, which is a rejective term for them. And, of course, that's a fiction aspect of things, literature, engagé and non-engagé, and how the battle between those, that's a different thing. More important, more interesting, I want to say this. You had your great fallout with Pantheon, and luckily for all of us, you didn't spend the rest of you're not spending your years now sitting in bars and telling everybody very embitteredly how they were, but you have taken up an antidote, so to speak, and have started a non-profit publishing house. So I very much want to know from you, and I hope everybody wants to know, how does this fare? Have you set an example that other people can follow? Is there indeed here an antidote to this poison, or is it a very Don Quixote type enterprise?
Well, you know, we're not the only alternative publishing house around, though we started in a different way of wanting, in effect, to follow what NPR and PBS had done in television and do the same thing for books. And we've been able to do that with the help of a number of foundations very successfully. So, you know, we've published now about 400 books, most of which have been very good books, including some marvelous fiction. And, you know, after 10 years, we're still above ground and have had a number of bestsellers. So part of the purpose of the new press, and anyone listening who wants to see what we do can look us up on the web at www.thenewpress.com and see the kind of books we're doing. Part of the purpose was to show that one could still publish these books, that one could find an audience, that the reading public had not changed, that the taste of readers had not been totally altered by television and so on, as people sometimes say. Now, having said all of that, you know, I think one of the more encouraging aspects of this otherwise very sad scene is that there are dozens of small publishers that have opened up throughout the world, throughout the country in recent years, and indeed much of the good fiction now comes from unlikely places. Now, this includes some of the university presses. I should point out that I've given unstinting and deserved praise to, for instance, the University of Nebraska, which amazingly enough is now the leading publisher of French fiction in this country, and Northwestern University, which is the leading source of novels from Eastern Europe and Russia. Now, not so long ago, that was the role that was played by Knopf and Farrar Straus and other mainline companies. But they have decided that this is insufficiently profitable, and they have turned their attention to other books, which will, like Joe Esterhazy's book on recent years in Washington and so on, which are going to make a lot more money. And that is, of course, one of the changes that the conglomerates have not only encouraged but required of publishers, that they abandon books that they might like very much and wish they could publish, but which are simply not going to make as much money as the bestsellers that they wanted to concentrate on.
Are you satisfied yourself that you have published books, novels too, which otherwise, without the new press, would not be in existence at the moment?
Oh, well, there's no question. And the interesting thing is, our first year, for instance, we had five works of belles lettres in fiction, all of which ended up on the Times' list of the best books of the year, and one of them on the top 10. The next year, three of the books we got from Britain ended up on the short list of the Booker Prize. Now,
So you do fiction?
Yes, indeed. We do important fiction.
Oh, I didn't realize.
No. In fact, we've published a huge range of authors, from well-known ones like Marguerite Duras to Jean Ischnaux, who won the Goncourt last year in France, and whose next novel we're publishing in the spring, and so on and so forth. And part of the reason for doing that is that no one else, except for the university presses I mentioned, was willing now to take the risk of publishing foreign fiction. So it's an important part of what we're trying to do. And there are still readers, but there are fewer readers. We have to admit that. And also the infrastructure of support that used to exist with libraries and others who had a budget to buy books of this kind has, in the Reagan-Thatcher years, been decimated. So it's much, much harder now to find an audience for books, no matter how good they are.
I am told repeatedly that there are sort of 10 to 12 million people in the U.S. interested in literature. The trouble is that the number is more or less constant, supposedly. The trouble is that it would be very expensive. It's very expensive to reach them because it's not a homogenous market. And that's one of the great troubles with the present situation.
No, that's, 10 or 12 million is a hell of a lot of people. And it's the number of people who listen to PBA. As an NPR each week, and I've never heard any of those people complaining that they lack listeners. On the contrary, these readers are very easy to reach because the newspapers now realize that much of the interesting fiction is coming from the smaller alternative presses, happily. And there's no reason why people should not know that these books are available. And of course, there's the websites and so on, like the one I mentioned, where people can inform themselves. But I don't think in the 10 years we've been publishing that there's a single work of fiction, translated fiction that we've done, that has not been favorably received by the New York Times. And I don't use that as the criterion, because the New York Times can be arbitrary in many instances.
Yes.
But people have certainly learned about these books and been able to find them. The problem is that in the past, as I say, you could count on libraries to buy these books, to have enough money to buy them, and you could count on university courses to assign them and so on. And that audience has increasingly been cut back by budgetary pressures.
Now, there's such an enormous clamor at the moment in the marketplace that you really you have to spend a fortune to be heard. How do the economics of your operation work?
Well, we've been fortunate in that respect, in that a lot of our books have, by virtue of their very quality, been able to rise above the clamor, as you call it, rightly. There are 70,000 books published each year in the U.S. We did 70 last year, which is 0.1%. On the other hand, one of our books, John Dower's marvelous book on the American occupation of Japan, won the National Book Award, the Bancroft, the Pulitzer, the L.A. Times book, et cetera, 9 of the major awards. And as a result, a book that would normally have appealed to a relatively small number of historians has sold 50,000 copies to a much broader audience. And we have, time after time, been able to break through the sheer quality of the books. to the audience they deserve. Now, that doesn't always happen, and there's some marvelous books that I can mention that have sold much more modest numbers. But on the whole, because the output from the large firms has so deteriorated, we get a fair shot at getting reviews and getting attention.
But are you satisfied would you with open eyes accept a book of which you know you will only sell 5,000 copies?
Oh, we do that all the time. We accept books for which we'll sell 1,000 copies. I mean, part of our purpose in becoming a not-for-profit publishing house and therefore not having to give profits back to the owners at the end of the year is that we could have what we call our scholarship fund. In effect, it's as if we were the last university in the country that could give scholarships on merit. So a book is accepted on the list because of its merit, not because of its potential contribution to overhead and profit. Now, obviously, there's a limitation. We do only 70 books a year. There's a limit to the number of books we can do that lose money, as opposed to those we know that will earn money. But nonetheless, I don't think we have yet turned down a book that I felt was important culturally or politically.
Now, I'm certainly not mercenary about writing and publishing, but in this context, it is unavoidably, it's interesting to know how does this affect the writers and how does it affect your own editors? Do they have to willingly make a sacrifice for the cause, or can you see no great difference in what it means to their income from being with you or being with one of the
Well, in most cases, they wouldn't be with one of the conglomerates. The other large publishers wouldn't touch them with a barge pole. So we have long made the policy decision that neither our junior staff nor our authors should suffer from the fact that we're a not-for-profit and we pay people a fair royalty and an advance and so on and so forth. But we don't pay the excessive advances that the large corporations pay to maintain their best-selling authors. We try to pay people what we think realistically their books will earn, and of course in some cases that is relatively modest.
And your advertising budget is presumably much more limited than you would like it to be.
Well, it's true that we can't buy the full-page ads in the New York Times as we would love to, and we can't afford the vast amounts that the chains ask for what they call co-op advertising, which is a euphemism, in effect, for bribery in many instances. but still, I mean, we can advertise the books in the appropriate places, and I think, you know, the track record on the whole is that the books have had the attention and the sales that one could hope for. Now, in many instances, as I say, and that's true of the university presses as well, those numbers are much lower than what they used to be.
How does the distribution work?
Well, we're lucky in that we're distributed by one of the few remaining independent publishers in the country, which is W.W. Norton, whose list has the same intellectual and cultural values that we have, so we're comfortable with them. But, of course, they are at a disadvantage vis-a-vis the conglomerates in that they don't have, you know, the huge sales forces and the huge advertising budgets that that the big houses have. So the problem of maintaining independence applies not simply to the not-for-profits and the university presses, it applies equally to the commercial houses.
And Norton, it's no longer Donald Lamb, is it?
Well, Donald retired just very recently, and he's been succeeded by a man called Drake McFeely. But you know, the company, as you may know, is owned by its cadres, by its higher echelon authors, editors, and so on. So it's a unique setup. It's a more or less guaranteed independence, and whoever comes in then gets a share of the firm and a share of the profits and then relinquishes that when they retire. So that's one of the reasons we chose Norton, that it's one of the few firms which we can feel pretty sure will not be sold down the river.
And they were happy to be chosen?
They were indeed. They've been very helpful partners from the very beginning and very supportive.
It's rather it's sort of a prestige thing for them, I assume.
But you know, we sold $5 billion worth of books last year. It's not something on which they lose money.
Right. For instance, you mentioned, I'm very bad at names, but somebody who's won the Pulitzer Prize and various other prizes.
Right, John Dower.
Does it then happen that, that one of the big people sort of try to steal them from you?
Well, they could try, but I think, you know, John, who took 10 years to write this book, you know, was very happy to stay with us, and we published his previous books at Pantheon. We published a previous book at the New Press. So one of the interesting things is that when my colleagues and I left Random House, when Pantheon was in effect closed down, only three of the hundreds and hundreds of authors we published over the years elected to stay behind with Random House or with Knopf. So most of the authors, I think, supported our project and supported what we were trying to do.
Right. So if I see this rightly, it is really a very personal thing. It is not that there's no recipe which easily is copied somewhere else.
Oh, no, no. On the contrary, I think it's a model that can easily be copied. I mean, we had the advantage that I had been working with authors for some 30 years who knew me and who were willing to join us at this adventure. But that doesn't mean that small presses can't succeed independently. Most of the presses are run by young and inexperienced people who are learning to do this very effectively. There's a small press in New York, presses called Seven Stories, which recently published a new book by Kurt Vonnegut. They republished all of Nelson Algren's novels and so on. Now, for Kurt Vonnegut to leave the behemoth of Bertelsmann to go with a small and relatively new publisher is a sign that he has confidence in these young people. And, you know, increasingly you have both aspects. You have, when Random House was sold to Bertelsmann, Bill Styron, who is probably their leading fiction author, said, you know, that Random House had grown so bloated and so gigantic that it no longer mattered to whom it belonged. Well, when your leading authors feel that way, you know that things have reached a very bad pass.
Yeah. Well, what I meant more specifically with this personal, that it's a matter of excellent taste and courage, that it's not a matter of making great economic sacrifices to publish the way you publish.
No, it's not meant to be. I mean, I think it's only fair that an author should not be asked to make a sacrifice in terms of, you know, we pay the same royalties and so on as anyone else does. What has to be realized, and that is a major change, is that for most authors of fiction, you know, the old system no longer works.
Yes.
They're not going to find publishers among the big houses. They're wasting their time if they try. And, you know, they have to find, and I think they can find, very good publishers among the wide range of houses, from Grey Wolf in Minneapolis to Seal Press in San Francisco to, I can go on listing dozens and dozens of them, houses for the most part run by very able and dedicated young people who will do a good job for them.
Right. Well, listen, there's endlessly more things to ask, but our time is about up. I hope you come back one day. Andrew, thank you very much, and the best of luck.
Not at all. Thank you very much for having me on the program.
You have listened to Andrew Shifrin, who is the publisher of The New Press in Manhattan. He leaves me a bit puzzled, because if it works so well, and if it's not dependent simply on the person, in this case on Shifrin, who has a 30-year record and knows everybody, then one may ask, well, why, what is this fuss about? Well, the first is about that somehow it is almost impossible to do this. But we get back to that, specifically next, for our next program, which will be on October the 26th, the fourth Thursday of the month, at the usual time, 12 noon. And very much hope to see you, or rather have you listen in at that time. You have listened to Literary Discord. I'm Hans Koning, and the producer is Scott Harris.